next time. I've been Kobe Tawi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يجدون ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. The US announces a new package of military aid for Ukraine, a move expected to provoke Russia's anger ahead of a summit between the US and Russian presidents. Iran says the United States' selective removal of some entities from its sanctions list is not viewed as a sign of goodwill. Also ahead, a UN special rapporteur expresses concern about the reports of the torture of 5 imprisoned human rights activists in the United Arab Emirates. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the United States has announced a new package of military assistance for Ukraine. The $150 million worth of aid includes radar systems, drones, and secured communications equipment. The U.S. Defense Department says it is in addition to $125 million in assistance announced in March. According to a Pentagon spokesman, the military shipment is aimed at helping Ukraine preserve its territorial integrity. The U.S. has provided more than $2.5 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since 2014. That's when a conflict flared up in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces have declared independence. The new aid comes ahead of a meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in Switzerland next week. Gilbert Doctorow is an independent political analyst joining us out of Brussels. Gilbert, welcome. The timing of this, it comes just days ahead of the meeting between Biden and the Russian president. So you're thinking it's not the best way to de-escalate tensions here?
No, I think your analysis, your mention of the timing as being critical to influence the forthcoming summit. I agree with that notion. At the same time, I question the idea that the Pentagon is united and has a single voice. Surely within the Pentagon, just as in other leading institutions in the United States, opinions are divided about Russia and how to best handle it. In the case of this announcement, it's clear that one side of the Pentagon, or certain officials within the Pentagon are looking to limit the results of the summit, to hinder the summit, to present obstacles to Joe Biden in his outreach to President Putin. At the same time, it is my own view that that other forces within the Pentagon have been among the leading influences pushing Biden to hold this summit so early in his presidency. It is in timing, it is not much different from what preceding presidents have done, but in the case of Biden, considering his hostility to the Russians and to President Putin in particular, it is remarkable that at this stage, relatively early in his presidency, he has chosen to meet with the Russian president. Now, why do I say that one part of the Pentagon would be would have been pressing an agenda of an early meeting? It's because within the Pentagon, there are certainly the best people to appraise the strategic threat that Russia poses to the United States globally. Generally speaking, the United States, Russia is viewed as a declining power, it's viewed with a certain retrospective consideration of its weakness in the 1990s, and the belief that the country is now unable, due to its limited GDP, to present a significant rival. The reality is that Russia has become the single strongest strategic threat to the United States military position. And it has, thanks to new weapon systems that were announced by President Putin 3 years ago and which have been implemented since, and these include the hypersonic cruise missiles, the weapon systems that are designated as Kinjal on guard, Russia has become a more advanced in strategic weapons than the United States itself. So the Pentagon is split.
Right. Gilbert, when you assess the background to all of this, the United States, Washington has provided $2.5 billion in military aid to Kiev since over the past few years, I think since 2014, if I'm not mistaken. And you would expect something in return from Ukraine. What do you think that, according to what you say, certain aspects of the U.S. establishment, not all of it, what do they want in return for that money?
They want to keep Russia off balance. They want to hinder Russia's strategic focus and its ability to project its geopolitical might globally by keeping Russia distracted, concerned over its national security. Any strengthening of the Ukraine, which is deeply hostile to Russia today, means that Russia's military forces have a distraction very close to their borders. And that we have seen in the build-up of Russian forces at the frontier a couple of weeks ago. If Russia is focusing its efforts to bolster its security in terms of the Ukrainian threat, then it is less able, in the view of these thinkers in the United States, it's less able to focus on its global ambitions and
right.
to pose a threat to the States.
Okay, Gilbert, thank you very much indeed for your analysis there. Gilbert Doctorow, that is, independent political analyst, joining us out of the Belgian capital, Brussels. Now, Iran has called on Washington to effectively and verifiably remove its sanctions on Tehran, calling the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign a maximum failure. In a tweet, Foreign Ministry spokesperson urged U.S. President Joe Biden to stop following in his predecessor Donald Trump's footsteps. Saeed Khatibzadeh also said that Washington's recent move in lifting some sanctions has nothing to do with the Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. He added, the selective delistings don't signal any goodwill in the face of what he called renewed U.S. economic terrorism. On Thursday, Washington repealed the sanctions on three former Iranian officials and two companies, describing the move as a routine administrative action. A senior U.S. official said that the move was not related to the Vienna talks, but claimed It was part of, quote, Washington's good faith approach. Political commentator David Rubian says it's not a question of goodwill when it comes to the U.S. having breached the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 on Iran.
Quite simply, there is no goodwill. There is international law. The United States has maintained illegal sanctions against Iran and shown its animus towards the Iranian nation for decades. In the last 3 years, through its maximum pressure sanctions, not only has Iran lost up to $1 trillion in revenue, but Iranians have suffered and died as a result of this maximum pressure campaign, being denied critical medicines, especially at the height of a global pandemic. And so, you know, let's get real, as Medea Benjamin would say, there is no goodwill. There is international law. There is United Nations Resolution 2231, and there is the potential for a verifiable lifting of all sanctions, illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that is what the negotiators from the Iranian team are looking for in Vienna. And they're not looking for simply these supposed goodwill gestures, which I would have to agree. This is quite a step forward relative to what, you know, the Trump administration say would have done, which was, right at the height of the meeting, placed more sanctions. And so certainly it could be considered a step in the right direction, but there is no good faith. There is clearly delineated international law and the parameters of United Nations Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA, and the United States needs to return to compliance with international law and those parameters for the negotiations in Vienna to be successful, irrespective of things that it might do on the side to show its supposed goodwill.
And Iran says it has regained voting rights in the UN General Assembly after its outstanding dues to the world body were paid. The announcement was made in a tweet by Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takhtravanchi, said illegal U.S. sanctions have not just deprived Iranians of medicine, but also prevented Iran from paying its arrears to the UN. He called for the immediate removal of, quote, all inhumane sanctions. UN spokesman Farhan Haq also confirmed that Iran had paid the minimum amount needed to regain its voting rights. Iran had earlier proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the dues. Iran was able to vote in the General Assembly on Friday to elect 5 new members of the UN Security Council. Some election news now regarding Iran. The Iranian elections, the country is set to hold the third and final round of televised debates between the 7 candidates in the race for the upcoming presidential election. The topic of Saturday's debate is the concerns of the people. Ibrahim Raisi, Nasser Himmati, Mohsen Rezai, Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, Mohsen Mehri Alizadeh, Saeed Jalili and Ali Reza Zarkani will outline their plans and exchange ideas in a 3-hour forum on Iranian national television. So, just a week to go before Iran's presidential election, candidates are trying to woo voters to win the race for the country's top executive post. Presidential candidate Ali Reza Zarkani says the U.S. can return to the 2015 nuclear deal after terminating all sanctions and offering legal guarantees and verification. Zarkani said his possible government would consider potentialities in Eastern countries like Russia and China. He noted that logical interaction with Western countries should also be considered. He stressed that interaction with Washington is meaningless as long as it intends to uproot the Iranian nation. As for Saudi Arabia, Zarkani recommended that Riyadh should accept its mistakes and put an end to its crimes in Yemen. Iran's presidential candidate Abdel Nasser Himmati has criticized some limitations that have been put on women and young people as meaningless. He said the youth are not happy with the current situation because there is too much pressure on them. Himeti said some fundamental changes should be made, adding that he has plans to do so in order to witness more active presence of the young people in the social and economic fields. The presidential hopeful also slammed the sanctions imposed on Iran as cruel that have affected people's livelihoods.
People's livelihoods have been affected by cruel sanctions and unfortunately by actions of some groups that always undermine the measures. Sanctions have inured heavy losses and disrupted our sources of income. Some people belittle FATF, but I think it is very important. We, along with one or two countries, have been exempted from having financial transactions with the rest of the world. The whole world is based on banking and financial transactions. Our exports have been disrupted, and our transaction costs have increased too much. All these are impacting the country's economy to a great extent.
And Iran's presidential hopeful Mohsen Rezai says he will make policy to deal with neighboring countries seriously if elected to office. He said there are differences in ideas with neighbors that should be resolved. Rezai said his government will be the pioneer in resolving issues depending on the will of the neighboring countries. The presidential candidate also said he would activate the national economy regardless of the outcome of the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
Our government will remain committed to all international obligations. The JCPOA is an international commitment that was violated by the U.S., but we will remain committed to the deal. It is important to force the U.S. to fulfill its commitments. We will pursue right diplomacy, but we will not be waiting for any agreement in Vienna. By reactivating national economy, we will minimize our independence on the U.S. as much as possible. They should feel that the more time they waste, the more they will lose. We will start boosting our national production, and they are the ones who would be following us.
Exciting times for the Iranian nation. As always, elections are exciting. Now, a United Nations expert has called on the United Arab Emirates to immediately release five imprisoned human rights activists. Mary Lola described their sentences as excessively severe. The five activists are part of a group of 94 lawyers, human rights defenders, and academics who were sentenced to 10 years in prison in July 2013 for allegedly plotting to overthrow the UAE regime. Lawla expressed concern that they have been subjected to torture by being held in solitary confinement for long periods. She said their right to a fair trial may also have been violated as they were denied or given limited access to legal counsel. The U.S. Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders stressed that they should have never been detained in the first place for legitimately exercising their freedoms. Now, the Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli troops have killed a Palestinian teenager during a protest in the occupied West Bank. Fifteen-year-old Mohammed Saeed was shot dead in the village of Beita, south of Nablus. At least 110 other protesters were also injured as Israeli troops fired live rounds and tear gas at them. The demonstrators had gathered in Beita to voice their anger at the construction of new settler units near the village. They set fire to tires and hurled stones at Israeli forces. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for months over Israel's settlement activities, as well as the regime's planned eviction of Palestinian families from their homes. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Election and political participation is a way to choose an official or officials for a specific post. Election is the symbol of people's rule over their own fate. However, elections in some countries are quiet, ceremonial, and a mere show of democracy. In Iraq, there are two kinds of elections. One is the election of city councils. Each province in Iraq is considered as a domain and enjoys its specific administrative establishment and provincial council. The other election is the parliamentary election. The president is also elected by the parliament. The president should be a Sunni Kurd. The parliament speaker should be a Sunni Arab. and the prime minister should be a Shia. In Syria, the president is elected for 7 years. Parliamentary and city council elections are other elections that are held in this country. In Kuwait, there are elections for city councils and parliament. The parliamentary election functions stronger in this country in comparison with other Arab countries in the region. Saudi Arabia is the only country which has not experienced any elections so far. The monarchic regime has never allowed the people to go to ballot boxes to elect their desired officials. The United Arab Emirates has a parliamentary election every 4 years, which is totally ceremonial, as the parliament has no power before the royal family. Bahrain is just like the UAE. Yusuf Al-Huri, Bahraini political activist, says on democracy in the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region, "The fact is that the systems of the Arab countries of the Persian Gulf region have not come to power on the basis of election. The ruling systems in these countries have rather come to power by colonialist systems like Britain, and they are supported by this country so that they may be able to continue their rule and exchange interests with each other. Today, we know it well that it is the British who caused Al Khalifa to rule in Bahrain and have supported them so far," unquote. Dear listeners, the same is true with Saudi Arabia. The system of governance is almost the same in Kuwait, UAE, and Qatar. In Qatar, the only election that is held is related to the city councils. But in Oman, as a royal system, the members of parliament are elected by people. In Lebanon, there are three kinds of election: the presidential election, the parliamentary election, and the city council election are held in this country. The president is chosen by the parliament. In Jordan, there are two legislative houses. The members of the House of Commons and the Senate are appointed by the king, while the representatives of parliament are elected by people. In North Africa, democratic process is more obvious and has a longer record. In Tunisia, for instance, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held. Elections are more seriously pursued in the country after the nationwide uprising and Islamic awakening in 2010. In Morocco, as a royal system, there are two elections for the House of Representatives and the House of Advisors. In Algeria, both presidential and parliamentary elections are held, while in Sudan, only the presidential election is held. In each of the mentioned countries, various elections are held, but participation is very limited in many of them. That's why free and fair election has always been one of the serious demands of people. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As the war in Yemen is raging on, the Saudi-led coalition is getting to the end of its tether in the face of Yemeni resistance groups, above all the Ansarullah movement. The Saudis have now to meet their nemesis at home in what many expect to be the final stages of the bloody war, not least because the Saudis and their accomplices have been enervated in a war of attrition they kindled 6 years ago. Not surprisingly, as one of their last-ditch attempts to save face, the Saudis are now busy issuing denials of heavy defeats on the front lines, and at the same time fabricating feats for their crestfallen forces. Recently, the Yemeni army and the fighters from the popular committees released new videos of a major operation carried out on May 28th against the Saudi kingdom's forces and mercenaries.
The operation was quite exceptional because it was extremely well fought. It is on the territory and high ground that the Saudis were in control of, and the large number of Saudi and Sudanese and other Yemeni who support the Saudis and are considered as a mercenary. The large number and the high equipment quality that they had did not prevent Ansarullah from occupying it.
The Yemeni's Al-Masira television channel reported that in the operation, sensitive targets were hit across the three strategic mountainous areas of Jabal Abdud, Al-Rami, and Jafan in the southern Saudi region of Jizan. According to the report, more than 80 mercenaries were killed, and at least 32 armored vehicles were damaged. The Yemeni forces reportedly managed to take full control of dozens of sites in the Saudi region after the mercenaries, who included Sudanese forces, were pushed back. Yemeni forces managed to seize control of at least 40 sites in the mountainous region, after which the Saudi Air Force sent warplanes that inflicted damage on their own military equipment. Given the recent achievements in southwestern Saudi Arabia, Yemen's Supreme Political Council has announced that the Yemeni side is prepared to exchange the bodies of those killed during the operations with Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis have stepped up their retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia in recent months, saying they will continue unabated as long as Riyadh carries on with its bombardment and blockade.
We saw the number of the Houthis was inferior to the number of the people, the Saudis and the Sudanese and the other occupying the position. And that also another lesson to learn from the military tactic point of view. And we saw that the light infantry can really defeat highly equipped forces when they're not motivated, they are not the owner of the ground, and they are there because they've been told that they want to occupy a foreign territory. However, we saw from Ansarullah Houthis that they are the owner of the ground, and this is what permit them to think less about the sacrifices they need to undergo in order to recover their own territory and liberate it from the Saudi occupation.
Meanwhile, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, recently announced that the army troops and allied fighters from popular committees have hit sensitive targets in King Khalid Air Base in the Saudi city of Khamis Mushayt, some 884 kilometers south of the Saudi capital, Riyadh. The overnight attack was carried out by two of the country's domestically developed Qassam-2K, Stryker-2K combat drones. Earlier this year, Yemen's Air Force carried out a number of operations against sensitive and important sites in Saudi Arabia, including Abha International Airport.
This is was very clear that there is an axis of the resistance that is coordinating its knowledge at passing on information and sharing experiences. The attack that Ansarullah carried out reminded me of the same attacks Hezbollah used to carry out against the Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon in the 90s. However, now today, with modern equipment, with anti-tank missiles, and with more advanced knowledge on how you occupy a high ground, particularly from the war that Hezbollah was engaged in Syria to liberate the Syrian territory from the Takfiri extremists. And we saw this happening on the Syrian-Lebanese borders. We saw this happening in the Kalamun area in Syria. And we saw exactly the more or less the same reproduction in Jizan and on high ground. Therefore, the simple conclusion is there is a shared experience among the axis of the resistance, and Ansarullah are part of this axis, and they are learning from those members who have been through the same experience, and they're implementing it, and it resulted successfully.
In one of its latest articles, Foreign Policy has analyzed the situation in Yemen, saying Yemen's popular Ansarullah movement won the U.S.-sponsored war waged by Saudi Arabia, stressing that the losers are now in no position to dictate terms to the victors.
It said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman launched the offensive on the assumption that it would bring an easy victory. Instead, it became a public relations debacle, as Saudi Arabia not only publicly brutalized a desperate and impoverished population, but also proved incapable of defeating a ragtag group of rebels, despite billions of dollars of U.S. military hardware. The Saudis' recent willingness to negotiate a ceasefire reflects their weakened position.
The Saudis, they thought they're coming to a ground, to a territory that is on a promenade, and they will finish the war in a few weeks. This is what Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said at the beginning, and that was 6 years ago. And we understand today that this war is exhausting the Saudis' resources, and it's giving no results at the exception of destroying Yemen and creating the largest humanitarian crisis in the poorest country of the Middle East. However, this Saudi attempt to continue and not to back off in their failed attempt to occupy Yemen, it is something that the Saudis, I think, are thinking about carefully, and because the results are very slim, or no result at all.
In reaction, the Saudis are claiming that all the attacks and defeats are fabricated by the Ansarullah movement, a statement that does not hold much water given all those footage and documents released by the Yemeni side. Through downplaying the achievements of the Yemeni side, the Saudis are seeking to salvage their reputation. After all, who would take seriously a kingdom which cannot win a war against the poorest forces of Yemen? In spite of having a coalition on its side, a bunch of world powers in its camp, and an arsenal worth billions of dollars at its disposal.
In the limelight.
A new survey of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, More Than Two-Thirds of American Students Want Police Out of Schools. Stay tuned for the details, please. A new study of more than 600 middle and high school students across four American states finds that 41% feel very unsafe or unsafe when they see police officers at their public schools. One-third said they feel targeted by police based on an aspect of their identity, such as race, primary language, sexual orientation, or gender identity, and students reported bullying and sexual harassment by police at multiple public schools. When asked what does make them feel safe at school, students overwhelmingly said teachers and friends, and more than two-thirds said police should be removed from school altogether. Only 16% of students said police make them feel safe. Courtney Blake, a ninth grader in New York City and youth leader with the Urban Youth Collaborative, which conducted the survey locally, said the findings make her feel disgusted and angry at the system. These are the experiences of young children and teenagers across the country, yet it feels personal because they reflect how I feel, Blake said in a statement. At school, police don't make me feel safe. Instead, they make me feel like I did something wrong. The in-depth survey of recent and current students of public schools in Oregon, New York, Nevada, and New Jersey reveals broad support for the student-led movement to remove police from schools and increase funding for teachers, student programming, and mental health supports. Activists are relatedly fighting to end the school-to-prison pipeline, which refers to policies and practices that isolate students and color immigrants and students with disabilities from supportive learning environments and instead funnels them toward the criminal legal system. This puts the students at risk of being incarcerated or, in the case of undocumented students, deported or separated from family members. Redirecting funding from police departments to education and social programs is also a long-standing goal of the movement for Black Lives that has inspired nationwide protests against the over-policing of communities of color. Of the students surveyed who report seeing cops at school, 50% said they have seen police interrupt learning to remove students from the classroom, and 1 in 5 reported that the cops verbally harass or make fun of students. Alarmingly, students reported sexual harassment by police in 3 of the 4 local areas surveyed, and more than a quarter said they have seen students arrested at school. The students who reported a police presence at school, 32% said they saw police at school on a daily basis, and 95% said they see cops at least once a month. Students also reported frequent interactions with security guards. 30% of Black students said they interact with security guards on a daily basis. Metal detectors are more common at majority Black and brown schools, and students of color were more likely to be searched and have belongings taken by police or security guards than white students. In the Las Vegas School District of Clark County, more than a quarter of students reported that they or someone they know has been pepper sprayed by police at school. School police in the district made headlines after using pepper spray in response to fights between students in recent years, with dozens of students and faculty pepper sprayed in one high-profile incident. Schoolyard fights can be used to justify the presence of police in schools, but when asked what they would like to see more of in school, students overwhelmingly chose additional resources and support for students and teachers over police and security. For example, 78% said they would like to see better mental health support and youth-led programs dedicated to increasing access to college, while only 8% said they would like more police. The survey was conducted by students and community groups that support the movement to remove police from schools and focused largely on diverse public schools located in urban and suburban areas. Schools where at least 75% of students are Black are more likely to have police officers and on-site security than schools where a majority of students are white, according to federal civil rights data. Many students know that black and indigenous adults and teens, for example, are more likely to be targeted, brutalized, and even killed by police outside of a school. Nationally, reams of data show that students of color and students with disabilities are disproportionately referred to police or arrested while at a school, and black students are more than twice as likely as white students to be disciplined by cops, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. Students with disabilities are more than three times as likely to be sent or arrested by the police, a disparity that is much wider in some states. A study conducted in New Orleans during the 2018 to 2019 school year found that only 40% of black students said they felt safer around police at school compared to 69% of white students. What did we do to deserve police in our schools? Blake said. It deserves support and resources, not police. Racial justice experts say students of color have always been systematically excluded from learning and marginalized at schools and universities, reflecting the deeply entrenched racism and white supremacy in education going back decades. Civil rights groups argue that students with disabilities, as well as black, indigenous, and other students of color, often have to attend public schools with fewer resources, accommodations for students with disabilities, and supports for staff, making teachers more likely to call on police to deal with behavioral problems. The survey also found that 56% of students who say their school is majority black report going through metal detectors on a daily basis, which can make a school feel more like a jail. Among the students who have metal detectors in their schools, 34% of black students report that their belongings have been confiscated compared to 14% of white students. Black and Latino students were also more likely to have been asked to remove their shoes to be searched than white students.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Americans have always supported Israel to maintain its military superiority in the region and prevent acts against it by Arab nations. Right now, the Israeli regime is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the post-World War II era. According to the U.S. Congressional Research Service, Israel has received $146 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money as of November 2020. From 1971 until 2007, the bulk of these funds was fundamental in helping Israel establish a strong economic base. Between 1973 and 1991, $460 million of U.S. funds was allocated to resettling Jews in Israel. Many of these new settlers are now those who occupy the West Bank illegal settlements. Under the guise of charitable donations, tens of millions of dollars are regularly sent to Israel in the form of tax-deductible gifts for Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, according to the New York Times. Much of the money, falsely promoted as donations for educational and religious purposes, often finds its way to funding and buying houses for illegal settlers, as well as guard dogs, bulletproof vests, rifle scopes, and vehicles to secure illegal Jewish outposts deep in occupied Palestinian areas. Since then, most of the money has been allotted for military purposes, including the security of Israel's illegal settlement enterprise.
It is important for America's national security to ensure that we have a safe and secure Israel, one that can defend itself.
In 2016, the U.S. promised even more aid. Then President Barack Obama signed the biggest military assistance agreement with Israel ever made by the U.S.
Today, we're making another unprecedented commitment to the security of Israel and the Israeli people. Like any discussion between friends, these talks have had their shares of twists and turns. But I think the end result speaks for itself. The Memorandum of Understanding we'll be signing shortly commits to providing Israel $38 billion in military aid over 10 years, including $33 billion in foreign military financing funds and an unprecedented commitment of $5 billion for missile defense. This marks a significant increase over our existing funding, and it will ensure that Israel has the support it needs to defend itself by itself and to preserve its qualitative military edge. This is the single largest pledge of military assistance to any country in U.S. history.
In December 2016, Israel became the first after the United States to receive the U.S.-built F-35 stealth jet to enhance its Air Force's ability. According to official congressional documents, the U.S. also may approve additional sales of the F-35 fighter jet and accelerate delivery of KC-46A refueling and transport aircraft. Quite often, U.S. money ends up in the Israeli government coffers under false pretenses. For example, the latest stimulus package includes $50 million to fund the Nita M. Lowy Middle East Partnership for Peace Funds, supposedly to provide investments in people-to-people exchanges and economic cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians, with the goal of supporting a negotiated, sustainable two-state solution. Most of this money is not included in the official U.S. aid packages to Israel and therefore receives little scrutiny, let alone media coverage. The mounting death toll from Israel's campaign of airstrikes against Gaza has thrust U.S. military assistance to the regime into the spotlight. A small group of Democrats now call for conditions to be placed on the several billions of dollars Washington gives Israel each year.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight, I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so so that when we die together. And no one would live to mourn the loss of another one. The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
While unemployment and poverty levels in the U.S. have skyrocketed as a result of repeated lockdowns, Washington still provides Israel with $3.3 billion in military assistance and $500 million for U.S.-Israel missile cooperation.
We have a responsibility to conduct oversight over our government's foreign policy and what happens with the millions of dollars we send in aid. So I would encourage my colleagues to visit, meet with the people we were going to meet with, see the things we were going to see.